Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. My next guest has been leaving no small footprint on the planet during his 68 years. Conrad Black ran the Hollinger Media Empire, owning newspapers worldwide from the Chicago Sun-Times to the Daily Telegraph in the UK, the National Post in Canada, and the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia. Canadian by birth, he became a British citizen in the 90s and is a member of the House of Lords. He served more than 3 years in prison here in the U.S. on charges stemming from claims of embezzlement from his company. He was released last year and has always maintained his innocence. Black's new book also leaves no small footprint. It is a 700-page history of the United States' role in the world, with an introduction by Henry Kissinger called Flight of the Eagle, in which he says Americans' prominence in world affairs came from good decisions over hundreds of years, more than any accidents of timing and geography. But he sees the U.S. in serious decline today. We will talk history, media, and the state of the world today with Conrad Black. Mr. Black, thank you for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
You use the word predestined in conjunction with American prominence in the world. That makes it sound God-given more than man-made. What do you mean by predestined?
Well, I guess I was taking up on a standard American theme, but I think it's fair to say that there is a combination of the factors you mentioned in your intro. Did have from the start access to populate a large and rich continent, and the ability, as it turned out, to attract very ambitious immigrants from all over the world. But the same could be said of Brazil generally, and Brazil is a great country, but it hasn't had the influence the United States has, and the difference is the thing I made. So the point I attempted to make of the extremely innovative and often courageous decisions of American statesmen at key stages in the country's development, all operating within the framework of the Constitution devised at the beginnings of the country. And the combination of those factors gave it, I think, an element of predestination: the English language, the democratic tradition, the rich continent to populate, but then the tendency of achieving and elevating inspired leadership when it was needed at each stage as the country developed.
And yet you write that the term American exceptionalism was always to some degree a fraud because of the treatment of African Americans and the comparable democratic rights of the British, Dutch, Swiss, and Scandinavians. Do those countries have better democracies than the United States?
Yeah, most of them do now, yeah, I think so. But I want to put that in context. I wouldn't want your listeners to think that I was anything other than profoundly respectful of the fact that the United States has led the world to the triumph of democracy and the free market in most of the world. And those of us in other countries must never forget that and never fail to be grateful for it. And that is a point I emphasize heavily in that book. But I think at this moment, today, the United States certainly is an unambiguous democracy, but it is not one of the best functioning democracies. But these things evolve, and the United States always deals with problems as they arise. And it is true that I think objectively, and I think most Americans would agree with this, the country is in a period of some decline at the moment. It is not irreversible, and it's certainly not a free fall. It's still a great country. What I would say about exceptionalism is that it is today almost entirely a matter of scale. It is still the country of the greatest activity, economic and otherwise, in the world, but it is not an exceptionally free country, and I can attest from my own observations and experiences, it has a terribly flawed justice system with an absolutely unconscionable number of incarcerated people, and at a 99.5% prosecution success rate, 97% without a trial. That is not what the authors of the Bill of Rights had in mind.
And in relation to that, you criticize the U.S. for the war on drugs, as well as for the incarceration rate and what you call a rogue prosecutocracy that terrorizes the country, your words, winning 99% of its cases. Did this view grow out of your own experience as a criminal defendant, or did you hold it before?
It was accentuated by my experiences. I was concerned before at the fact that the U.S. had 6 to 12 times as many incarcerated people per capita as other advanced, prosperous democracies, specifically Australia, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, and Japan. But I had not obviously had any reason to recognize some of the more worrisome aspects of it until I came in contact with them personally.
Conrad Black, my guest on WNYC. His new book is Flight of the Eagle. We could take your phone calls, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. I'm interested in your critique of American capitalism, too. Near the end of the book, you write that through the financial crisis of 2008, the mystique of American capitalism was vaporized, that the whole architecture of the American economy was based on, quote, consumer appetites and an addiction to the service industries and an unsustainable snobbery of preferring to work in skyscrapers rather than in industry, unquote. Do you mean the U.S. economy is now based on producing the wrong things?
I'm afraid there is an element of that. The legal profession, for example, I don't mean to harp on this, and I certainly would do you and me an injustice if between us we gave your listeners the idea that this book has anything to do with my own travails. You can attest that they're only mentioned in a disclosure note at the very end of the book, and they do not color the narrative, which is unambiguously admiring of the United States and
yes.
history. I mean, not uncritically so, but unambiguously so. And I think that in the case of capitalism, I mean, I'm a capitalist. I'm a pure capitalist, and if I may say it, I'm a well-known capitalist and have been for a long time, an outspoken one. And it has its faults, but it's the only economic system that works because it is the only one aligned with the almost universal human desire for more. But the challenge is to harness the motivation that ambition provides without leading to sociopathic results. But I was shocked as a capitalist and as one who had dealt with all of the big New York banks, the merchant banks and the lending banks, I was shocked at the exposure of their groupthink, their lack of discernment, and their sleazy practices. I mean, I accept that the leading executives of Goldman Sachs, for example, did not know this was going on, but I don't dispute that. But the fact that company was pushing out the front door billions and billions of dollars worth of real estate-backed securities that they must have known were quite possibly worthless, at the same time that they were short-selling them out the back door in their own house accounts, it's just absolutely shocking. Now, I'm not suggesting it's criminal. I believe Lloyd Blankfein, and he says he didn't know what was happening. But the fact is it was happening, and it shouldn't have been happening.
So how do you see your home country of Canada in this context? Because as we've talked about before in this program with other guests, almost the entire private lending banking system became basically insolvent in the financial crisis of 2008. Those are actually your words from your book, but certainly that concept was out there, except Prudent Canada. Is it that Canada's banks had not gone in for the fancy derivatives and mortgage products to propel its housing market as the U.S. and the U.K. and Ireland and all these other countries did?
The problems in those other countries weren't entirely of the same nature as in the United States, but that is part of the answer. In Canada, you have these factors. There are only really six banks in the whole country. Country of 33 million people, but still only six banks. They're all very large, very well established. Secondly, you have a more conservative banking public. The savings rate in Canada is never much below 10%, whereas official policy in the United States through most of the Greenspan years was essentially to discourage savings and push people into other things, whether equities or residential housing or whatever. And third, the regulatory framework in Canada is such that it confines the banks to certain ratios that would discourage the kind of risk-taking that you get in the banking sector, certainly of the United States and some other countries. I must tell you this. I think more shocking was the failure of the Scottish and Swiss banks. I mean, I always assumed that nobody, absolutely nobody, could bank as well and as cleverly as the Scottish and the Swiss, and they went down, most of them. That was a real shocker. But frankly, what happens in Scotland and Switzerland is scarcely of the same level of importance as what happens to the institutions in New York.
My guest on WNYC, publisher Conrad Black, his new 700-page history of the United States' role in the world and contemporary analysis is called Flight of the Eagle. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC. And David in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. I want to push a little harder on the question of so-called American exceptionalism. I'm very glad to hear Conrad Black sort of go back into that, re-examine it. I, you know, as a historian and, you know, and as a social scientist, you know, I've been a little alarmed by the way that the phrase American exceptionalism has been cheapened in current political discourse to suggest that simply America is an exceptional country. Well, that could be said of a lot of countries, and certainly America is a remarkable and fine country. But I think the phrase refers to a number of ways in which the United States has diverged from the old world from which it sprang and with which it still is, you know, to which it is still closest. For one thing, you know, the United States has not had to worry about security challenges from its neighbors, unlike the contemporary European countries, because it had a vast ocean on either side of it. It was founded, indeed, in the European Enlightenment, and yet it was free to develop Enlightenment ideas, a constitution based on the Enlightenment and the ideas of the philosophers, without having to overthrow the institutions of old world government, such as a monarch, an aristocracy, and a religious clerical establishment, an established church.
I understand. Now, let me get Mr. Black's reaction to what you're saying. Mr. Black?
Yeah, well, I agree with David. He didn't say a word that I did not agree with, but I would just say this, that as Brian said in his intro, that I had suggested that exceptionalism as a concept was a fraud, and to some degree it was. But I would like David and the other listeners to know that I said that rather admiringly. I credited Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine with founding this American genius at public relations and the spectacle and in effect, propaganda. And they took what was, in large measure, a somewhat grubby tax dispute where the British had doubled their national debt largely to evict the French from Canada because they were a terrible nuisance to the American colonists, and then called upon the Americans as 30% of the British population in the world and the most prosperous part of it to help them retire this burden. And the Americans invented this doctrine of no taxation without representation. And the war took place on that basis, and Jefferson successfully put it across, along with others, as the dawn of human liberty. But Americans as citizens at the end of that war had no more rights than they had had before and no more rights than the British had. What they did have was a resident government. But with that said, I agree with what David said, that the U.S. then was able to develop free of the legacy of feudalism and oppression by aristocrats and so forth. But let's not imagine that there's been no oppression and there's been no incursion on social justice in the abstract. I'm no leftist, but let us not delude ourselves into imagining that exceptionalism ever meant in the United States there was a perfect society, starting with the outrage of slavery.
Let's take another call. Nadia in Fort Lee. Did I say your name right? You're on the air.
Yes, correct. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
I would like to comment on Mr. Black's sentence that he said the world should appreciate what the United States has done about democracy. And I am from Iran, and I know what the United States has done in Iran. The only democracy that was coming to Iran by Mossadegh, one of our prime ministers, the United States failed it. And these are the documents that is now openly written, and Mr. Black knows about it. And this is not the only work that the United States has done. The support of all the dictatorships like Saudi Arabia and other countries is very open right now, and Mr. Black knows about it. So
Nadia, I'm gonna leave it there, but I'm gonna frame your question to Mr. Black in as large terms as I can, because Mr. Black, your book is such a long-range history of even, you know, before the official founding of the Republic, the establishment of the U.S. as a preeminent country in the world. And despite the fact that we've been talking mostly in this conversation about your contemporary critiques of the United States, it's an overwhelmingly admiring book, as patriotic as if you were a flag-waving American yourself for the most part. But in terms of foreign policy in the last 60 or 70 years, would you agree with the premise here that the U.S. has kind of gone awry in its policy with respect to the Middle East in particular, supporting dictators all over the place, and in the case that she raises, the overthrow of Mossadegh in the 1950s in Iran by the Shah, largely because we became too hooked on the needs of our consumer economy to have cheap oil?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I agree with what Nadia said in some respects, and I discussed the Mossadegh affair, and I agree President Eisenhower, with some connivance from Mr. Churchill, threw Mossadegh out, but it was masterminded by Theodore Roosevelt's son, by the way, in the CIA. But I do not agree that Mossadegh was an authentic Democrat. I think the Shah was a much better and more capable ruler, even though he was certainly not a Democrat. But it was not the mission of the U.S. to achieve the triumph of democracy exclusively by supporting purported Democrats in the world. Just let us remember, I was born in 1944, and at that time, there was no more democracy in the world than there was when the USA was founded. It was essentially the same countries. Now, admittedly, a few countries, the French and the Dutch in particular, hoped to get democracy back when they were liberated, but essentially it had made no progress. The Americans defined the Cold War once they realized the extent, the strategic team that governed it, that Roosevelt had assembled, even though Roosevelt himself was dead, Truman, Marshall, Eisenhower, Bolin, Kennan, and others, Acheson, that they defined it as a battle between the free world and the godless totalitarian communists. And in that context, they had to allow into the free world the Shah, Franco, Salazar, Nadia's right, the Saudis, Syngman Rhee, all these crooked juntas in South America. It was a fraud in that sense, except that it won the Cold War, and almost all those countries, unfortunately not Iran, but the Spanish and Portuguese and most of Latin America, did become democracies. So, I think Nadia's right that the U.S. has sometimes supported dictators, but they've done so in the larger context of producing a satisfactory result in the overall strategic objectives of the United States, and the world has benefited from that, but not equally and not uniformly. As for the Middle East today, I think American policy has been completely confused. I shouldn't say completely, but largely confused since the days of, at the latest, since the mid, they were late Clinton era, there have been some mistakes. At no point do I suggest the policymakers of the United States are infallible. But it must be said, the foremost democracy in the Middle East is Israel, and the U.S. has a respectable record of supporting Israel.
How much of a turning point do you think the current foreign policy moment is? The decision over whether to get militarily involved in bringing down Assad, and how that relates to President Obama's larger goal of disengaging the U.S. from the Middle East to the extent possible and the larger Muslim world?
I've just posted a piece which will be up, I think, later today in the National Review Online, for which I write every week, in which I've commented on this. And I think what we've had since the debacle in Vietnam is this oscillation between attempted nation building, which has been a complete failure and an insane concept, other than when the nation being built was on the ashes or ruins of what had been an advanced country to begin with, namely such places as Germany and Japan after the war. And on the other extreme, when that doesn't work, as it didn't in Vietnam, did not in Somalia, and has not more recently in Afghanistan and probably Iraq, in between we get bouts of isolation. And the fact is, what's being proposed in Syria by the advocates of intervention is not boots on the ground. It's not another Vietnam or even another Somalia, which started as a program to distribute food aid. It is some assistance to indigenous elements antagonistic to a regime that is a terrorism-supporting regime, a conduit of the present regime in Iran to Hezbollah and Hamas, and a disturber of the peace in the Middle East and elsewhere, and a government, the Assad government, this Assad and his father, who have severely provoked the West many times. And my position is that what we should do is discourage that by, when it is practical and relatively easy, helping to get rid of those regimes. It is not the business of the West, the United States in particular, to be responsible for how those countries are governed internally. That's up to them. And if the regime succeeding Assad is worse in domestic terms, that's not our concern. But it is less likely to be provoking to the West if whoever succeeds knows that the previous regime was thrown out because it did provoke the West. And by the way, when Obama was finally shamed by the French and British into getting involved in Libya, we did get rid of Gaddafi. It was a terribly brutal way of doing it, but he was got rid of by his own people, and what has succeeded him is definitely an improvement, not only in international conduct, but in domestic policy.
We're over time. I appreciate the conversation. I just want to ask you one more thing. As a newspaper publisher, or maybe technically former publisher, but what do you think of the financial prospects for journalism, and by that I mean paying for real reporting, as a business model in the post-newspaper world, in the internet era?
I'm not a pessimist about it, but it is the most colossal metamorphosis that we've seen in any industry for certainly in my time. And as you have said, and I've admitted, I'm getting a little elderly, though I don't feel like it. And essentially, the newspaper business was conducted in the same way for over a century of knocking down trees, turning them into newsprint, and printing papers and distributing them on the ground all around metropolitan areas. Well, that will change, but I think the desire for actual reporting and the need for it will not decline. But what I do think is going to be emphasized is the need for the skillful use of the editorial function, because the flow of information is so colossal and continuous, will be even greater than it has ever been before. Because even if a highly intelligent person had nothing else to do but try and find out what the news was for 16 hours a day, he or she still wouldn't get it all. So we're going to be more dependent than ever on editors to condense it in a way that works for each individual.
So there's that. But also, there are more people today, as I understand it, reading New York Times content, for example, than ever before. It's probably true of the Telegraph and the National Post and National Review, too. And yet they can't monetize it in the way that they did before.
That's got to shake out. You know, they can't. And as long as people will take for free what they don't have to pay for, that's what they'll do, obviously. But it's the revolution has been so sudden and so profound that it would be cartelism, and it would be impossible to organize a cartel so vast if everybody charged for content at the same time. We've seen one publisher after another put their toe in the warm water of trying to charge the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, and they're getting a little better at it now. And I think it will be a somewhat of a revenue producer. We got to remember, Brian, though, that if you can actually get paid for internet transmitted content, the publisher has a 100% profit because there is no cost of newsprint and there is no cost of delivery.
Yeah. Conrad Black, his new book is called Flight of the Eagle. It's a 700-page history of the United States' role in the world with an introductory note by Henry Kissinger. And thank you very much for spending this time with us. We appreciate it.
Brian, thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we conclude our series of candidate interviews in the race for the late Frank Lautenberg Senate seat with Republican hopeful Dr. Alida Eck. And then 100 ways to improve the subway. We'll talk to a designer who's trying to come up with 100. He's posted about 60 already on a Tumblr, and we'll collect some of yours and see if he might want to include them. Stay with us.